WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Molly Ivins, is a political columnist known as much for her wit as her political insights. She's a lifelong Texas liberal who never pulls any punches when it comes to describing what's wrong with Texas, or for that matter, America. Ivins writes for the Dallas Times-Herald, Mother Jones, and The Nation, and contributes essays to the McNeil Lehrer NewsHour. Her columns are collected in the new book, Molly Ivins Can't Say That, Can She? Here's the opening of her introduction.
In my youth, I aspired to be a great journalist. George Orwell, Albert Camus, and I.F. Stone were my heroes, great writers and intellectuals who helped illuminate their times. But look, God gave those guys fascism, communism, colonialism, and McCarthyism to struggle against. All I got was Lubbock. It's not my fault.
Do you still feel like you didn't get the big stories to cover?
I'm afraid so, although I must say there's enough real about the great state of Texas to keep anybody busy.
Well, it seems to me what your stories have turned out to be is Texas, women, and general overall stupidity in politics.
Well, it's hard to encompass the entire topic of stupidity in politics, but I have attempted to address it.
Why?
Well, mostly because it's sitting right under my nose and I find it hard to ignore. I've been writing about Texas politics for a long time, and that will give a person plenty of material.
You've written that as a lifelong Texas liberal, you've spent your whole life, your whole of your existence in a political climate to the right of Ronald Reagan. You're, in fact, from a family who was very right-wing. What was right-wing about them?
Well, my daddy was John Connally's campaign manager. I guess that qualifies.
Right.
I have to say, my daddy and I don't agree on much politically. In fact, it's true. About the political climate of Texas and what I think of as most of the real world. I define the real world as just about every place outside Manhattan Island. It has always sort of amazed and amused me that so many of these right-wing intellectuals, that they call the neoconservatives, seem to be operating under the bizarre impression that the world is actually run by people of the liberal persuasion, a notion I find so comical that I'm barely able to talk politics with those folks.
Were you ever an adolescent right-winger?
No. Mm-mm. I must say I turned out funny early.
What got you questioning the conservative worldview that your family had?
Well, I think all Southern liberals come from the same starting point, which is race. I grew up in the South before the Civil Rights Movement, and it was an era when all grown-ups lied. If you lived in the white part of town and you'd go to the drinking fountains, they'd say, "Now, don't drink out of that fountain, dear. That's dirty." That was the one that said colored on it. Well, of course, you lived in the white part of town, and kids had been crawling all over the white fountain all day. It was full of bubble gum and dirty grease marks and stuff. And you knew that the colored fountain wasn't dirty. There was something they weren't telling you. And you know how horribly logical little children can be. You just start picking up on those clues early on, and somehow I never got over it. The first great political question when I was coming up was civil rights, and I was in favor of it. And the second great political question to come along was the war in Vietnam, and I was against it. So people told me that meant I was some kind of double-dyed, full-blooded liberal. I said, okay, what did I know? Later on, people took to claiming that it meant I was in favor of big government and communism and high taxes. And that's when I figured out that I should never let anybody else define my politics.
Did you get into big fights with your family when you were coming of age and, you know, when you became a woman and started to have political views that differed with theirs?
Oh, yes. We ruined many a dinner discussing politics in my house. My daddy and I finally agreed not to do it anymore.
Is that still where you are now?
Yep.
Was your family prosperous? Were you a debutante? Did you have a coming-out party?
No, I was not myself a debutante, but I went to debutante parties. I suppose to some extent did grow up in rather a privileged world. I went to a private school in Houston, Texas, and later went on to Smith College and Columbia University. The flavor of my political opinions, I think, comes not from... In part, I think I grew up different from other girls of my background simply because I read a great deal. And I suppose there was an additional factor. I'm almost 6 feet tall, which makes it hard to be a sweet, dainty, pretty, feminine, little, sweet, proper Southern belle. I mean, they made me captain of the basketball team when I was 4, and that sort of went like that.
How were you introduced to the women's rights movement?
I'm trying to remember. Oh, I know. In 1972, I was editing the Texas Observer. I suppose it's redundant to say it's a small liberal Texas magazine. And Sissy Farenthold that year in 1972 was running, got nominated for vice president by the women's groups there at the Democratic Convention in 1972. And I didn't have any money as editor of the Texas Observer, and I was sleeping on the floor room in Sissy's hotel room in a sleeping bag, and kind of wound up as her aide-de-camp for this funny little effort to make her vice president that appeared. And that was when I first met Gloria Steinem and Betty Friedan and Bella Abzug. And I was kind of startled because I had not quite realized how much my opinion of those leaders of the women's movement had been influenced by the media. For some reason, I had thought that Bella Abzug would be loud and brash and brassy. And she's actually the most sweet-voiced woman and sweet-faced woman. I thought Betty Friedan had always seemed to me sort of vaguely like a witch. Well, she turned out to be the classic Jewish mother, apt to pour chicken soup down your throat at the first sneeze. And Gloria Steinem, I had sort of assumed would be some sort of spoiled darling who always wanted to be in front of the cameras. Well, she was the one who, after we would have these strategy meetings, she would, after everybody else had gone off to do something important, she was the one who would sweep the floor and pick up. And then that was what caused me to realize how much sexism I had been reading in the national media about these women and about the women's movement, how they had managed to slant those personalities.
When did you start writing about the legislature, the Texas legislature, and what was your early response to it?
My first session was in 1971, and I walked onto the floor of the Texas House of Representatives, and it looked sort of like the first day of school. There were 150 men all slapping each other on the back and patting each other on the butt and meeting and greeting and carrying on, and I saw one old boy dig another old boy in the ribs with his elbow and say, "Hey, fella, you should see what I found myself last night, and she don't talk neither." And the two of them went off chortling and snuckling. And I just thought to myself, you know, this is fabulous. It makes some people kind of sick, but very from the beginning, I just thought, this is reporter heaven. This is too funny to be believed. And I've been writing about it that way ever since.
It's good that you were able to keep your bearings and think that you were sane and they were crazy. Not everybody thrown into such a situation would be able to maintain their bearings.
Oh, if you had ever witnessed that collection of geeks and dorks and bozos we have in the state legislature of Texas, I don't think you'd have much trouble.
Do you think that the Texas legislature is any worse than any other states?
Certainly, we're number one bad, and I'll fight to the death with anybody who says we're not. Actually, I do have to tell you, of course, there's great politics over our neighboring state of Louisiana. And in a political storytelling contest, I often get a run for my money with folks from New Jersey and Illinois. But I have been in political storytelling contests all over this country with my fellow political writers, and I've never lost one. All I have to do is keep telling true stories about the Texas legislature, and sooner or later they all give up and say uncle.
Can you tell one of your favorites for us?
Well, there's so many it's hard to say, but perhaps my all-time favorite Texas representative was Mike Martin from Longview. He was an early harbinger of the moral majority. Got elected on a platform of being pro-family and pro-American, but frankly, if you'd put that man's brain in a bumblebee, it would have flown backwards. He could not get a single bill passed, not even memorial resolutions for people in his district who had died. So when it came time for re-election, of course, kind of hard to get re-elected if you hadn't done anything. Looked bad for Mike's re-election chances, but he came up with an innovative scheme. He paid his cousin Charlie to shoot him in the arm with a shotgun. Then he claimed it had been done by a satanic and communistic cult. And here were the law enforcement people running all over Texas trying to find some satanic communistic cult, which is fairly hard to do. And there was great uproar in the press about it, and everybody running around thinking people, the lives of legislators were in danger, and nobody knew what to think about it. Well, the plot came unraveled. Charlie had too much beer, as I recall, in a bar one night and spilled the beans. And I always point out, only the Texas legislature would have had the foresight to make it illegal to pay someone to shoot you. It is illegal in our state, so don't come down and do it, Terry. And with that, Mike Martin became a wanted man. But instead of facing up to his then legal difficulties, Mike Martin took it on the lam. He went underground. He went into hiding. And we had to send the Texas Rangers after him. They hunted him high, hunted him low. Took him 2 weeks to track Martin to earth. He was hidden at his mother's house outside Longview. And they actually found him hiding in the stereo cabinet. Now, many people have asked me what Martin was doing in that stereo cabinet. I'm here to tell you that man always did want to be a speaker.
Has the Texas legislature changed in the years that you've been a journalist?
You know, I wish I could tell you it's gotten better. I always think when I'm asked that question, people can say, oh, surely it's not as bad as it used to be. And I always think, no, of course not. They're much more serious and sober and responsible these days. And then some lunatic thing happens. I mean, something just so off the wall that you just sit back and laugh and say, no, it ain't changed a bit. Well, just this last session, we had some buttes. One night, about 30 members of the Texas House of Representatives bolted out of the place. They were trying to break a quorum, refused to vote again. The speaker locked the doors. They sent the Texas Rangers out after these 30 missing members. They had all gone to take shelter over in the governor's mansion. And we're hiding out there, and the mansion was ringed by police, and the whole thing was kind of festive, and I thought to myself, by George, only in Texas. This is a lot of fun. Then we had another kind of tragic incident. We had a lawmaker who died of a crack overdose. We think we're the first state on the block to have a lawmaker die of a crack overdose. While that was sufficiently depressing in a sort of typically frolicsome Texas political way, it turned out that before the guy's body was discovered, but certainly after he died, he continued by some magical means to vote. He was registered on several votes there in the Texas House after he was deceased.
If you're just joining us, my guest is journalist Molly Ivins. There's a new collection of her columns from over the years. It's called Molly Ivins Can't Say That, Can She? We'll talk some more after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Journalist Molly Ivins is my guest. The title of your new book, Molly Ivins Can't Say That, Can She?, comes from an actual story. Would you tell the story?
When I first started writing a column for the Dallas Times-Herald back in 1982, I found Dallas, Texas to be really quite a buttoned-up sort of town, really very proper. And they were not used to someone with my kind of freewheeling style. And I reviewed the performance of a local congressman. He was Republican from North Dallas, and took a look at what he'd done lately, and it caused me to render the judgment that if that man's IQ slipped any lower, we'd have to water him twice a day. Well, that, good heavens, touched off all kinds of outraged protests from Republicans around there, and they all threatened to cancel their subscriptions and start advertiser boycotts and such, and my paper did kind of a gutsy thing. They took out billboards all over Dallas, Texas that said, Molly Ivins can't say that, can she?
And what effect did that advertising campaign have? How did it go over?
Well, it's been real interesting. Every year they do polls to see who is the best liked and most hated columnist in Dallas, and I'm always both of them. So we figure that means people are reading it.
That's great. Now, is it right that the New York Times fired you for describing a community chicken-killing festival as a gang pluck?
That comes close to truth. I actually,
how close?
I resigned from the Times, but I was not in good smell with the powers that be, and it was over the time I tried to call that community chicken killing a gang pluck. They felt that was conduct unbecoming a New York Times reporter.
And how did they let you know that?
Oh, I had this hilarious interview with Abe Rosenthal, then the executive editor of the Times. I had been Rocky Mountain bureau chief for the New York Times for 3 years, covered 9 mountain states out in from the Canadian to the Mexican border. It was a wonderful assignment. And that's where I wrote the story about the community chicken slaughter. And when I got back to New York, I was abruptly recalled, kind of like a defective automobile. Abe hauled me into his office and We kind of went around about whether or not I was deliberately trying to stick my thumb in the eye of the New York Times, as I recall his words, and I explained that no, I never tried to do that, actually. I just never understood where they drew the line at the Times, and when it was pointed out to me, my honest reaction was always, you've got to be kidding. So we argued that up and down a bit, and then he said, in an accusatory tone, you tried to call that community chicken killing a gang pluck. I said, yes, Abe, I did. He said, gang pluck. I said, well, Abe, I thought it was a good line. He said, gang pluck. I said, hey, well, Abe, it's a play on words. He said, gang pluck. You were trying, that is a play on gang fuck. You were trying to make our readers think of the word fuck. I said, damn, Abe, you are a hard man to fool. You are going to have to cut that story. You know it.
I'm wondering, you know, some people from Texas end up telling stories about their state and everything. Do you think that some people camp it up a little bit when telling colorful stories about the South?
Yes and no. There's a genre of person that we refer to somewhat scornfully as professional Texans. I must say, sometimes I feel in danger of becoming a professional Texan myself. And people who, you know, have lived up here in the North and who dine out on old stories for many years, eventually becoming terrible bores to everyone, including themselves. There is an almost irresistible tendency to play Texan, however. I remember when I first joined the Times, the editors were taking me around and they'd introduce me to someone and say, this is Molly Ivan, she just joined the paper, she's from Texas. And people would look up very expectantly and say, oh, from Texas? And I found myself sticking out my hand and saying, howdy. You know, I just didn't want to let anybody down.
Right.
And there is an extent to which you play the role, particularly if you're a Texan in the North, because people expect it of you and enjoy it. And sometimes I feel when I'm in the North as though I speak two languages and they only speak one.
But you speak North and South?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Let me ask you about a couple of stories I'm sure you're following
sure.
now. If you were voting on the confirmation of Gates to head the CIA, what questions would you want to ask him before voting? What would you want to know?
Interesting question. I'm not sure you can get at the straight of it or even get him to say. I'm intrigued by the new charges. Not concerning Iran-Contra, but that he habitually tailored intelligence reports to meet political purposes, which seems to me a particularly pernicious practice. But I had already concluded on the matter of his involvement in the Iran-Contra scandal, or lack of same, that if this man was sitting there, number two in the CIA, with all these people all around him warning him and tipping him off and telling him about this piece of evidence and that piece of evidence, and he didn't have enough sense to figure out what was going on, then we don't want him as head of the CIA. I mean, honey, if he's fit to head an intelligence agency after a performance like that, then I'm about to be named National Junior Baton Twirling Champion.
How would you vote on the Clarence Thomas confirmation?
I think that my initial reaction on Thomas was wrong. My theory was that you might as well vote for him and not even bother to put up a fight because it's a done deal, and if by any chance you defeated him, the next nominee through the pipeline might look even worse. I have since concluded that I was wrong about that, and I was actually convinced by Howell Heflin's speech. Howell Heflin of Alabama, certainly no great flaming liberal, actually voted against Thomas on the Judiciary Committee and will oppose his nomination. And it seemed to me that Howell Heflin, who, and this is relatively rare, as we all know, for a politician, was certainly acting against his own best political interests. The people in his home state want Thomas confirmed by an overwhelming margin. But Heflin just stood up and said, he's not good enough. He's just not good enough. And all of us know, I mean, whether you think Thomas is an acceptable candidate or not, that George Bush did not simply say to the people around him, go out and find me the brightest and best qualified candidate, and that they came back with Clarence Thomas. Now, that just didn't happen.
So what do you think now would happen if Thomas is voted down? What do you think the next choice might be like?
I think the next choice is probably Edith Jones of Texas, or at least that's what we hear. And I'll tell you frankly, she's such a wretched choice that I think she could be defeated quite easily. And as you recall, after Nixon lost two attempted court appointees that he named, both of whom were unfit for the high court in almost everybody's opinion, then he finally turned around and appointed a very good judge, Harry Blackmun. I think the same thing might happen this time.
In Texas circles, do you ever end up at parties with some of the politicians who you cover?
Yes, I do. I have always been something of an outsider journalist because my political opinions aren't popular in my home state. But yes, I have over the years socialized with Texas politicians.
Does that make it harder to say what you want to say about them?
Not for me.
Do you ever learn anything that gives you insights into their character or politics from the parties?
I'm trying to think. Yes, I suppose so. Although, as a journalist, stuff that you learn that you can't use really isn't that much use to you.
I bet you see a lot of stuff that you can't use at those parties.
Yeah, but I love to make fun of politicians, and as far as I'm concerned, they're all in a free fire zone. But I do have some respect for their privacy. Even the dimmest of them actually devote a fair number of hours to public service, and I think they deserve some respect for their privacy.
Molly Ivins, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
All right. It was my pleasure.
And there's a new collection of Molly Ivins' columns over the years, and it's called Molly Ivins Can't Say That, Can She? This is Fresh Air.